Ever been in that situation, like maybe you will as a law student, thinking about future business deals, you know, where you've got everything seemingly agreed on, like a handshake, you know, the nod, but the actual paperwork, the formal contract, isn't quite finalized.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Happens all the time.
Makes you wonder, right? Like, can those informal understandings, those agreements that feel solid but aren't on paper, can those actually be legally binding?
It's a great question and one that comes up a lot, especially in a fast-paced business environment.
Exactly. So today we're going deep, a real deep dive, into a case that tackles this head-on. It's called Manetti v. Anker Hocking out of the Seventh Circuit from 1991.
Manetti, a classic case, really gets to the heart of how courts look beyond the formal contract, especially when we're talking about the statute of frauds.
Right, that rule about certain agreements needing to be in writing to be enforceable.
Exactly. And in Manetti, we see how things like memos, actions, those real-world business dealings can sometimes be more important than a missing signature on a formal document.
Definitely a case with some practical lessons for all you future lawyers out there.
Absolutely.
Okay, so let's break down the specifics of Manetti. We've got Manetti, an Italian company making food service products. They were in talks with Anker Hocking, a U.S. firm, back in 1984. Anker Hocking was going to be their exclusive distributor in the U.S.
Got it. So setting the stage for what? A distribution agreement?
Exactly. And Manetti, they really acted like it was a done deal. They went ahead and terminated their existing distributors in the U.S.
Wow, that's a pretty big step to take before everything is, officially signed.
Right. And they even went so far as to tell their customers, hey, look, Anker Hocking, they're going to be the exclusive distributor by the end of 84. But here's where it gets really interesting. Manetti transferred their entire U.S. operation, all the inventory, customer lists, even trade secrets, the whole shebang, over to Anker Hocking.
Okay, now that's a significant move. It
Yeah.
really shows how much they believed in this agreement.
And it highlights something really crucial for our listeners. Actions can speak louder than words. I mean, those actions, especially when they're so big and demonstrate reliance on the deal, can be super strong evidence that there was an agreement even without that formal signed contract.
Huge point. Yeah, Minetti wasn't messing around. They were all in.
But as you can probably guess, there's a twist. No formal signed contract was ever actually put in place.
Ah, so that handshake, those nods, didn't quite translate to a legally binding document.
Nope. So naturally, when the deal ultimately went south, Manetti sued Anker Hocking for breach of contract.
Makes sense. They felt they had an agreement and Anker Hocking pulled out.
Right. Now, the district court, they took a more traditional view, you know, kind of by the book. They said, whoa, wait a minute. We've got the statute of frauds here. Contracts for the sale of goods over $500, those usually need to be in writing and signed. You don't have that here. Case dismissed.
Yeah, the district court's really emphasizing that foundational principle of the statute of frauds. Makes you wonder, though, why would Manetti go so far if there wasn't something more to it,
That's what Manetti thought, too. So they tried to change their complaint, wanted to add a claim based on a legal idea called promissory estoppel.
Okay, promissory estoppel. For our listeners who might be a bit newer to this concept, it's basically a way for a court to enforce a promise, even without a formal contract, if one party reasonably relied on that promise and got hurt because of it.
Exactly. But the district court, they weren't having it, denied that amendment, too.
So what happened next? Did Manetti just give up?
Definitely not. They took their case up a notch to the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. And this is where the legal reasoning gets really interesting, really important for anyone studying law to understand.
Okay, so we've got this oral agreement for exclusive distribution, and the big question in front of the Seventh Circuit is, does the statute of frauds make it completely unenforceable?
Precisely. And the appellate court, they didn't see things the same way as that district court. They actually reversed that decision, said the statute of frauds didn't necessarily block enforcement of the agreement.
Interesting. So even without a formal contract, the Seventh Circuit found a way to potentially enforce this deal.
Yep. So how did they justify that? What evidence did they rely on?
Well, the Seventh Circuit zeroed in on a couple of key pieces of written evidence. First up was a memo written by someone from Anker Hocking, a Mr. Schneider, after a meeting in December of 84. Now, it wasn't some fancy legal document, not a formal contract, but it did lay out that the two sides had agreed on some really important things.
Okay, like what kind of terms?
Things like how exclusive the distribution arrangement would be and some pretty big minimum purchase requirements, $27 million worth of Minetti's products over a 10-year period.
Wow, that's serious money. So even though it wasn't a full-blown contract, that memo really showed they had a genuine agreement on those major points.
Absolutely. And that's a key insight for our law students listening. Even informal writings can sometimes be enough to show there was a contract.
Okay, got it. So what was the other piece of evidence?
The second bit of evidence was another memo, this one from Anchor Hawking's marketing director, Mr. Davis. And this one was written on official company letterhead, which gives it a bit more weight, a bit more formality.
Okay, makes sense.
And that memo from Mr. Davis, it backed up the idea that there was this exclusive distribution agreement in place. It corroborated what that earlier memo had said.
So basically, the court put those two memos together and said that was enough to satisfy the UCC's statute of frauds, even without a single signed contract.
Exactly. And that's something important to remember about the UCC, the Uniform Commercial Code. It governs contracts for the sale of goods, right? And under Section 2201, the UCC says the statute of frauds requires some kind of writing that shows a contract for sale exists and it needs to be signed by the person they're trying to enforce it against.
Okay, so it's not about having every tiny detail in writing, more about having something that shows there was a deal.
Right. And in this case, the court looked at those memos, especially the one for Mr. Davis on that company letterhead, and said, yep, that's enough to show a contract existed.
That makes sense in terms of the written evidence, but you mentioned partial performance earlier. That was a big part of why the Seventh Circuit reversed the lower court's decision, right?
Oh, absolutely. The Seventh Circuit put a lot of weight on the fact that Minetti had essentially handed over their entire U.S. business to Anchor Hawking. Remember, they terminated all their other distributors. They physically moved all that inventory. And most importantly, they shared those really valuable, intangible things. Customer lists, trade secrets, all that.
Yeah, they didn't just get ready to do business together. They actually started doing it.
Exactly. And that's where the idea of irreversible reliance comes in. The court saw this and said, look, Minetti took these massive irreversible steps because they believed they had a deal. Just giving them money back later wouldn't truly fix things. It's like once those customer relationships, those trade secrets are out there, you can't just magically get them back.
Right. So their actions were so significant, so final, that the court said, look, we can't ignore this just because there's no signed piece of paper.
And this idea of partial performance is powerful. It provides a completely separate reason to say, okay, the statute of frauds might technically apply, but we're going to enforce this agreement anyway because of what actually happened between these companies.
Really interesting. So we've got the memos, we've got those big actions by Minetti. But now this question pops into my head. Was this even the type of agreement that falls under the UCC in the first place? Distributorships aren't just about selling stuff, right?
You're absolutely right. Distributorship agreements, they're often mixed contracts. They involve both the sale of goods, like those food service products from Minetti, and then all the services that go along with distribution.
So the court had to figure out, would the UCC, with its rules like the statute of frauds, would those rules even apply to this kind of hybrid agreement?
Exactly. It's not always a simple yes or no.
Exactly. So how did they decide?
Well, they used what's called the predominant purpose test. Basically, they look at the main point of the contract, its core purpose. If the big goal, the driving force behind the agreement, is the sale of goods, then the UCC applies to the whole thing, even if there are some service aspects sprinkled in.
Okay, so in this case, what made the court say, yep, this is primarily about selling goods?
That $27 million minimum purchase requirement was a huge clue. The court looked at that and said, well, this is clearly about Anchor Hawking buying a whole bunch of Minetti's products to then resell. It wasn't so much about Anchor Hawking providing some kind of service. It was about them acting as this big buyer.
Right. The distribution part was just the way to make those big sales happen.
Exactly. And that's why they said the UCC, including its statute of frauds, applied to this case.
Got it. Now, one last thing to touch on. Minetti tried to bring that promissory estoppel claim, but the district court shut it down. Did the Seventh Circuit weigh in on that at all?
They didn't really have to make a firm decision on that because they already said the contract was enforceable based on those memos and the partial performance.
Okay, so they didn't need to go there.
Right. But they did hint at something interesting. They suggested that in some cases, if someone relied heavily on an oral promise and enforcing the statute of frauds would be really unfair, then promissory estoppel might be a way to enforce that promise, even if the statute of frauds would normally apply. But they left that bigger discussion for another case, another time.
Makes sense. So for all our listeners out there, especially the law students, what are the big takeaways from Manetti v. Ankerhocking? What do they really need to remember from all of this?
Well, first off, don't dismiss those informal writings. Memos, emails, detailed notes from meetings, those can be enough to satisfy the statute of frauds as long as they prove that there was an agreement for the sale of goods. Doesn't have to be super formal.
Super important in today's world, right? Where so much business is done quickly and through emails and things like that.
Absolutely. Second, remember how powerful those actions can be, that idea of partial performance. Courts pay attention to what each side did, not just what they said they would do. And if those actions show a serious commitment, if they can't be undone easily, that's really strong evidence of a contract, especially if money alone can't fix things.
Like transferring a whole business operation.
Exactly. You can't unring that bell. And lastly, always keep that predominant purpose test in mind, especially with agreements that involve both goods and services. Figuring out if the main goal is selling those goods will tell you if the UCC and its rules apply. It's crucial for analyzing those mixed contracts.
Great points. So when we look at Manetti v. Ankerhocking, it really shows us that contracts, well, they aren't always simple. It's not just about having a formal signed piece of paper. Courts look at the bigger picture. Those communications back and forth, the actions taken by the parties, and what that business relationship is really all about. They use all of that to decide if an agreement should be enforced, even if it doesn't perfectly follow the strict letter of the statute of frauds.
That's a great summary. And it leads to another question worth thinking about. You know, in today's world, everything's fast-paced, communication is instant, sometimes informal. So how do you think those principles we've talked about from Manetti v. Ankerhocking, how do you think those will shape the way courts look at contracts in the future?
That's something to think about for sure. How do we balance the need for formality for those legal structures with the realities of how business actually gets done in the real world?
Lots to ponder.
Lots to ponder indeed. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive, everyone. We hope exploring Manetti v. Ankerhocking has given you a better understanding of just how complex contract law can be.
Absolutely.
Keep those legal brains working, and we'll catch you on our next deep dive.